I'm John Kroll. Coming up on No Limits, we will talk about foreclosures in the central Indiana housing market. More than one quarter of all home sales in the United States involve a house in some state of foreclosure. We will talk about how we got to this point and what it means for Hoosiers who depended upon their homes not just for shelter, but as a way to save and provide for their retirements or their children's education. We will discuss whether things are getting better and what the road to recovery might look like. We will talk about all of this with our guests, Stephanie Reeve of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, Al Thorup of the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association, and Scott Smith of Keller Williams Realty. And, of course, you. You can join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending us a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Please do join us. First, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about foreclosures and the central Indiana housing market. We're fortunate to have as our guest Stephanie Reeve, the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority. Stephanie, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, John.
We also have with us Al Thorup, who is the executive director of the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association. Al, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, John. Appreciate being here.
And Scott Smith of Keller Williams Realty. Scott, good to have you here.
Thank you, John.
I want to talk, and I'm going to invite, this is the sort of subject, obviously, I think a lot of people feel somewhat touched by and may have questions, so I'm going to invite our listeners to call us at 1-866-476-3881, send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to start a little bit, if you could give us some sort of perspective. Stephanie Reeve, I'm going to start with you just by asking, how bad is it out there? I mean, how big a crisis are we talking about? That's the term they use with the foreclosure problem right now. Is it as bad as we think it is, or better, or perhaps even worse?
Well, we don't have a lack of clients contacting the Indiana Housing Authority, requesting assistance to get through this very troubling time. As you can imagine, when somebody goes through foreclosure, it's one of the most stressful times that they will ever go through. So, it's bad. I don't think that it's insurmountable. Certainly, homeowners at risk of foreclosure, given the proper tools and educated on what their options are, can often avoid foreclosure and can get through that time.
And you mentioned they can avoid foreclosure. How can they go about doing that?
Well, first of all, I would recommend contacting the Indiana Foreclosure Prevention Network, which is overseen by the Housing Authority. You can do that by going to www.877gethope.org or calling the helpline at 1-877-GET-HOPE. And basically, then you have, per Indiana law, the right to free foreclosure prevention counseling. So a trained foreclosure prevention counselor will work with you to discuss your options. Very often, lenders don't want their house. So very often, there are modifications. There are other what we call workouts that are available so that a foreclosure is prevented.
And Al Thorup, I think that was a cue for you of the Mortgage Bankers Association that lenders generally don't want foreclosure to happen. Why is that?
Well, first and foremost, it's something that's very difficult for people to deal with, including the lender servicers. Foreclosure is the very last option. And in addition to all the emotional stress that everybody goes through, lenders, servicers lose money every time a home goes into foreclosure. There's no financial benefit to a home going into foreclosure, not only for that individual homeowner and the servicer, but for the community as well. It is best for the communities in which these homes are in, these consumers are in, to stay in their homes, keep up the tax base, keep up the occupancy there. Abandoned foreclosed properties cause all sorts of issues. And lenders are out there, servicers are out there to try to help people, first and foremost, avoid foreclosure.
What's been the impact, Scott Smith of Keller Williams Realty, on the market in terms of selling houses, the foreclosure crisis?
Well, the crisis, I mean, has impacted our local area. There's no doubt. We've had foreclosures in the state of Indiana. Matter of fact, we used to lead. We've been one of the top states early in 2000 to 2005. We were one of the top foreclosure states. Now we've fallen down, probably to the 20th state or less than that. But the number of foreclosures that we're seeing on the market, we're starting to see the inventory creep up some. However, we didn't hit the spikes to where we're 70% of our market. Right now, we've reached 30%, but the actual number of foreclosures that are hitting our market, that are selling on our market, haven't risen dramatically as they have in other states. What has happened is that the normal resale properties, that volume has shrunk. Not nearly as many of those properties are selling at this time, which is causing the percentage to go up. It rose from about 20% up to 30%, up to 31% here recently as far as the number of homes that are selling. But that didn't mean that there's that many more foreclosures that are selling. It's just that there's that many or fewer properties that are selling that are normal resale.
Well, and what has this done to prices, basically? If you're trying to sell your house, and in some ways you're in a position where you have to sell your house or whatever, what does that do, Scott?
Well, real estate's a local market, not only just in Indiana, but within different sectors around the city and in different price ranges. What we're finding, if you're actually looking at the median or the average sale price, it's actually stayed the same, if not risen slightly over the last couple of years. I know that's hard to believe. That's contrary to common belief that they've really been falling, but they have been in certain sectors. If you look at the some of the higher price range homes up $500,000 or above, you do see a significant drop in some of those prices that have come down. But in the median sell range in between the 100 to the 150, that price range, for the most part, the average price of those homes has not significantly been impacted. But I understand for the person who's selling their home at that moment or that they're in foreclosure, they may not feel the same, and I'm not trying to lessen that in any way as far as their impact, because there are a lot of families right now that are, they are having a lot of trouble. So it's not trying to lessen, what they're going through in any way, because for them, it's 100% for them.
Tim, welcome to the program. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking. Understand you're calling from Noblesville, and that you've got a comment and a question.
Yes. And let me preface it by saying that this is an issue very much on my mind, to the extent that I have addressed the city council in Westfield, Indiana, and the common council here in Noblesville, and that is the proliferation of new single-family homes, what one might even describe as the cookie-cutter type of home, and they're just going up like gangbusters, almost, I would say, that would rival the development that took place in the 90s. I am concerned that there has been a very poor response from our local governments at preventing this. And in fact, when I've read some of the agenda minutes from past meetings, I've seen where the board has approved reclassification from maybe perhaps a low density to a high density of single family homes. So I do feel that the local governments can take some proactive measures, such as not reclassifying ordinances to allow for this type of thing. And it just seems, for lack of better words, unconscionable giving today's climate of that involves so many foreclosures, people that have to constantly reduce the sale price of their homes, they have any hope at all getting out from under it. It just seems like the elephant in the room that nobody's really talking about, and I will respectfully listen to your panel to respond to that.
Great. Thank you for the call, Tim. Well, to summarize, I think what Tim was talking about was really that we created kind of a glut of housing, that there were some zoning issues there, that maybe we've created an overabundance. Stephanie Reeve, that would seem to be the most natural fit for your area of expertise here. Sorry to put you on the spot, but that's kind of what they pay me to do.
No problem. You know, I can't actually speak to the kind of building or the kind of loans that we see most often from the folks that call in needing assistance. But what I can say is that the vast majority, I would say even 80% of the people that contact us because they're at risk of foreclosure, it's because there's been a change in their family status, death or divorce. They've gone through some significant medical issues and they have medical expenses. They've lost their job. 60% of our clients are calling because of unemployment or a reduction in income. So I take the caller's point, but we see a lot more life-changing events that cause these kinds of problems.
Yeah, Al Thorpe.
Yeah, John, I would like to add, and while I don't have the specific statistics, but in the Indianapolis metropolitan area, new home starts are down significantly from the earlier part of the last decade. I think we had, and Scott, maybe you can confirm this, upwards of 14, 15,000 housing permits in 2003, 2004, and I think it's about a third of that. So while there is construction going on, it does not approach what was out just 6, 7 years ago.
Well, I think Tim's point obviously was that during the 90s there was this huge expansion. I hope I am paraphrasing your point well, Tim, that it was done without a whole lot of forethought or planning, and we're now reaping the consequences of that. To some degree, it involves the role of what role government should have in this stuff in terms of planning, development, and all of that. Scott, what is your view?
Well, during that time period, we were obviously building those properties. However, we had buyers for those properties at that time. So it wasn't – we had buyers at that time. They didn't go into that house, and they didn't buy that house assuming that they were going to get foreclosed on within 1 to 2 years. That wasn't their hope. Their hopes and dreams were living the American dream and owning their own residence and their own home. I think because of different things that occurred, you know, within the economy and the different types of loans in some of those neighborhoods that he may be speaking of, that a lot of people getting into those with some sweat equity and being able to move into a property, maybe they were stretching their limits at that time with some of the lending practices. With some of the subprime type of mortgages, may have affected their ability to continue to pay their mortgage at that time. But I don't think that – I still believe there's a need for that type of property and that type of housing. People still want to have that American dream, and they still want to be able to own a home.
What parts of the central Indiana market – you mentioned that all real estate, you know, at some level is local here, and all of these questions are local. Are there parts of central Indiana that have been hit harder than others? And if so, where are they?
Well, central Indiana, if you look at the foreclosure numbers, if you just look basically at the statistics within Marion County, that's one of the highest foreclosure rates as far as within the counties. There's other areas. One thing that is surprising, I ran some statistics the other day showing that the number of homes that were foreclosed upon above 100,000 in sell price on there, back around 2000, it was down around 40 to 50. Now we're up around 1,400. So it's not just affecting one particular price range of a home. It's actually spreading into, you know, there's homes that are being foreclosed upon over 500, over a million. So it's not necessarily just in one particular area or one particular price range of home.
We are talking about foreclosures and the central Indiana housing market here on No Limits. I would invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. We have as our guest Stephanie Reeve of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, Al Thorpe of the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association, Scott Smith of Keller Williams Realty. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about foreclosures and the central Indiana housing market. We're fortunate to have as our guests Stephanie Reeve of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, Al Thorup, who is the executive director of the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association, and Scott Smith of Keller Williams Realty. Kathy, welcome to the program. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine. And yourself?
I am doing well. Thank you for asking. Understand you've got a question.
Question and a comment.
Okay. We'll take both.
I was moved to call by the first two comments that your guests made, both about the Get Hope Now network and about banks not wanting to foreclose on homes, or I should say lenders not wanting to foreclose on homes. Let's not say banks. I and my husband just finished the last payment on about a 14-month forbearance plan that it took me over 6 months to get from our servicer. Our servicer is City Mortgage. And during due to job loss, my husband and I got behind on house payments. Not only was City Mortgage not helpful during that time, but they were very difficult to get a hold of. When one of us got a job and we were finally able to start making some sort of payments again to try and catch us up, I went through an over 6 month process calling both my servicer and the Get Hope Now group, trying to get our house, stop it from going into foreclosure and then get it out of foreclosure eventually. I got nowhere. The people at Get Hope Now were very positive, and they seemed to try to help, but it felt like they were hamstrung by what they were able to do. In addition, the only help that they actually gave me was by giving me a couple of alternate numbers, which by taking those numbers and the numbers that I already had for City Mortgage, I just got creative and started randomly calling phone numbers that would probably fit within those parameters until I finally got somebody who was willing to talk to me and got me through to the right people, and I eventually got on a forbearance plan. But it took over 6 months to do it, and the fees and fines and numbers, just the sheer amount of money that was racked up during that time, was completely unnecessary, and I don't feel that I should have had to fight that hard when we were honestly making an effort. It became almost a full-time job trying to get our house out of foreclosure.
And Kathy, is your house is out of foreclosure now?
We just finished about a 14-month forbearance plan, yes, which actually pretty much doubled our mortgage. By the time we got it into the forbearance plan, it was pretty much effectively twice our mortgage. So many things in the past 14 months have had to be let go, including maintenance on the house, because there was no way to squeeze any more money out of our budget.
Well, first, before I let you go, congratulations on averting that disaster. We will take your question up. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Certainly. Stephanie Reeve, that would seem to be aimed somewhat in your direction, although I from the looks around the room, I think everybody wants a piece of that question and or comment. So,
yes, I mean it's a very frustrating process, and I would like to if we could have gotten that caller's information offline, I would love to have the opportunity to follow up with her. To see, you know, if there's anything else that we can do now that she's wonderfully out of foreclosure. It sounds like she's got an unaffordable mortgage payment. There might be an opportunity where we could modify, or we could work with her lender to modify the loan. I don't know if that's possible, but I'd love to follow up with her after.
We will see. Kathy, if you wouldn't mind calling back and leaving your information with our producers, we'll see if we can get you some information that would help you. Is that, and I'll say frankly, that's one of the things that, you know, unfortunately in this era we live in, most of us know people who've been through some level of foreclosure. And that is a persistent complaint that I hear, mm-hmm. that even when you try to signal that you're in trouble and that you want to try to work with people, it's impossible to get the information or to get somebody who is in a decision-making capacity. Al Thorup, you're nodding your head the most emphatically here right now. Is it a valid complaint? And if so, what can be done about it, particularly on your end of the equation.
Yeah, John, it is a valid complaint, and part of the issue has been, early on especially, the delinquencies came somewhat as a, if you would, a tidal wave. Our industry was geared in the mid part of the last decade for refinancing and home purchase at all-time record levels. Not long after that period ended, delinquencies and foreclosures shot up, and to a great extent, there were not the people to service those loans that were going into delinquency and foreclosure. Another challenge that our industry has had is that at both the federal and the state level, the rules change regularly. And keeping people up to date, keeping consumers in the right path has been difficult as these rules have changed time and again. Recently, from the Federal Reserve, the Comptroller of the of the Currency, and the Office of Thrift Supervision, there's been a consent orders going out, and one of the major components of that is a single point of contact for the consumer, so that once a consumer gets into a default situation or just prior to a default situation, they can call up their servicer and have one person take them through the process. That is going to be a logistical challenge for our industry, as you can imagine, but that is something that we're embracing, and going forward, we're going to do what we can to continue to help the consumer. But having assisted the Indiana Foreclosure Prevention Network myself in the past, I ran into some of the same challenges that Kathy had with trying to get a hold of somebody to help consumers.
And is that, Stephanie Reeve, in terms of the people with whom you work and talk, is that a persistent complaint or sense of frustration? You're already in a bad way, obviously, because you're concerned that you're losing your home, and then to be able not to get somebody to return your phone calls or even know which number to dial, I would think has to be maddening.
Maddening would be an understatement. It's very difficult to know who the right person is to talk to, whether the person you just spoke to on the phone, who might have been very helpful in understanding if they were the right person to talk to. And so what we hope to achieve with the Indiana Foreclosure Prevention Network is the counselors have been working through, and we have been working to create, as Al mentioned, contacts in each of these large servicers. So we know at Chase who to call, or at Citi who to call. So we're getting better at that, and we're hoping to facilitate that. And it does make it much easier.
Now, are you adequately staffed to do that? I mean, a persistent theme seems to be here that this was like the tsunami that caught everybody off guard here. Do you have enough people to handle the volume, or?
We are managing the volume that we see, and we could even see some more volume. So I think we're okay in that regard.
Brad, welcome to the program. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm
certainly
going to try and make this really short because it's an extremely long story, but I'm really disappointed at the servicers. And I was laid off. I spent 15 months trying to find a job. I paid my mortgage that whole time. I finally was able to find a job out of the area, and so I had to move. My house was $40,000 underwater. There's no way I could sell it. I had an initial 80-20 loan that was from day one on the property. I tried to negotiate with the 20. They wouldn't even negotiate, and they told me, well, you're not behind. You don't have any problems. We won't even talk to you. They wouldn't even talk to me. They wouldn't even respond to letters. So I went into the short sale process. I lost two buyers that both waited around over 3 months because the banks would not settle on how much they wanted. The third buyer waited around 4 months, and then the banks turned around and agreed on how much they're willing to accept. By this time, from the first offer to the third offer, the offers had gone down $30,000 from $130,000 to $100,000. And then after they waited 4 months to decide on how much money to accept, they gave us 3 weeks to close. And I'm sorry. I'm lucky that I had a very good real estate agent. And, I mean, we talk about calling and the way she interacted with everybody, and she had another person in her office that was helping, but and I would constantly go in there and say, what's going on with this? And they would show me all their logs and everything, all the people they've contacted and everything. And I mean, it was ridiculous. And it was like the it's like they had no skin in the game. And I've been told from the realtor and told by other realtors, too, that they're not losing money. It's actually the people that own the loans are the ones losing the money. It's the servicers are keep making money through the whole thing. So I don't know if that's true, but that's my frustration.
We will take that up. Thanks for the call, and appreciate you listening to the program. Well, first place, I think I'd like to talk a little bit about terms here because, well, I know you folks all live with this. I suspect there are more than a few people out there who have no idea what a short sale is and all of that. So would someone jump in with a quick definition here of short sale? Scott Smith.
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to take that one. Mm-hmm. A short sale is basically they own the home, mm-hmm. and we'll use an example that they owe $150,000 on the property. The property, unfortunately, may not be worth that amount at this time. Say it's only worth $120,000. And what you're doing is you're going back to that lender and asking them, or let's say that is their loan amount, $150,000. They're asking the lender to forgive that difference for a full and complete payoff of that particular loan. So basically, they're taking the short on that particular loan in satisfying that loan in full.
Okay, so what it means to walk through some of the terminology here real quickly is that the lender then agrees to accept back less money than was loaned in the first place.
That's correct. And depending on that particular seller's situation, they may allow them to forgive that debt in full, or else they may go back and they may want some relief from that debt and they may have to take on a personal loan on top of that.
How common a problem is this, where you have people who have to do a short sale like that? Al Thorup.
Yeah, it's a significant problem, in part because for a good part of the last decade and before, down payment requirements got to be very low to zero. And historically, you've had down payments, you've been able to finance 100% if you're a veteran mm-hmm. over the years. But part of the industry's reliance on low down payments has been the steady increase in the value of homes to where there was equity. But it is a significant problem out there today. And, as was mentioned earlier, we are fortunate in this area that we don't have as many short sales as we do. Up in the Detroit metro area, for instance, they've had as high as 80% of their properties sold either short sale or through foreclosures or some other means.
Well, and that's sort of – go ahead, Scott Smith.
Many times it's not necessarily the original loan that they're upside down on. Many times it may be a second mortgage that they may have taken after they've purchased the property that has increased the amount of debt on that particular property.
Well, and I think that begs the question. I'll toss this one back to Al Thorup, the executive director of the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association, and just raise the question, how did we get to this point? I mean, what steps led us here to the point where, at least in this country, we have a significant number of homes that are in foreclosure? How did we get to this point?
Well, long story, but in general, housing has been one of the bedrocks of our society. Our culture values owning a home. And so starting in the mid-70s to late-70s with federal government passing the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, the Community Reinvestment Act, and up into the 90s where other regulatory and legislative actions were taking place in Washington and throughout the country. Our politicians, our people in Washington and in the states wanted to increase home ownership. So they made changes and they required lenders to provide better opportunities for people to own homes. And it happened. And part of what happened was people got into housing. And as somebody from one of our agencies had indicated in a presentation I was in years ago, back in about 2008, people were underwritten and approved to buy homes, not necessarily own them. And because you can buy a home doesn't mean you should own a home, because there's a lot to that, much more so than there is renting.
Dill, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing today, okay?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
I love your show, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. understand that you're an attorney here in town. And
I'm a bankruptcy attorney here in town.
Okay, well, then I suspect you have a question on point.
Well, it's not exactly a question as much as it is an observation. I deal with foreclosures on a daily basis, obviously. And the thing I've noticed over the last, 18 to 24 months is that I'll have a client that'll come in and we do the numbers and we're going to surrender a house. So we file a Chapter 7 or 13, usually a 7. We'll surrender the house. And, of course, the lender still has to go through the state court process to get the property to a sheriff's sale. Well, that takes a very long time. And the crazy thing is that I'll have clients that do a 7, they get their discharge. It's usually about 105 days from beginning to end in the process. And they still live in the house because the sheriff's sale hasn't happened. But then finally, when they get the 30-day notice of the sheriff's sale, they get contacted by the lender to say, hey, you know what, let's really see if we can make a deal now. I guess you're serious about this, and maybe we can work something out. And that just strikes me as bizarre, because I have had so many clients that if they had simply done that at the front end, they never would have filed a bankruptcy.
Good question. Thank you very much for calling.
You're very welcome.
I think, Al Thorpe, I'll throw that one to you and then bring it back to Scott Smith. In terms of that, what is the reason for the timing? Is it a volume issue, or go ahead.
Yeah, part of it is volume, and part of it is the requirements that the state has for foreclosure. And, in fact, we here in Indiana, we are a judicial foreclosure state. And as such, there's rules and guidelines that the caller is much more aware of than I am, mm-hmm. in order to get a home to that standpoint. One of the things that it's a challenge in that we don't want to have a lot of abandoned foreclosed properties out there, but we don't want to push people out too early either. So do you try to speed up the process and get people out quicker, or do you want to lengthen the process and allow them a greater opportunity to modify and to get their loan up to date? And it's tough. It's a tough balancing act for all involved.
Scott Smith.
I think there is a little bit of a change in the tide as far as what the lenders are trying to do at this time. One, because we have what they call the shadow inventory, and that's what the banks basically have in inventory that they've already foreclosed on. Right now, if you look at our statistics, we have about 17 months of inventory, which is around 10,000 properties in our local area here that has not hit the market yet. They're holding off the market at this time. So I don't think there's a large want to push more on into that shadow inventory.
You mean the banks are just holding the properties until there's a better moment? I want to make sure we understand the concept here.
Yes. I mean, basically they have foreclosed on some of these properties, but they have not yet put them on the market. And by releasing them at a slower rate is also helping keep the prices up, although we do have some vacant properties that are sitting out there. So by allowing the people to stay in those properties and hopefully working that out, there's a better chance that, one, the property is going to be maintained, and, two, we're not going to be adding to that shadow inventory.
We are talking about foreclosures and the central Indiana housing market. We're fortunate to have as our guest Stephanie Reeve of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, Al Thorpe, the executive director of the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association, Scott Smith of Keller Williams Realty. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about foreclosures and the central Indiana housing market. Our guests are Stephanie Reeve of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, Al Thorpe, who is the executive director of the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association, and Scott Smith of Keller Williams Realty. You can join the program, join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Scott, you had a point you wanted to make about how we got into this mess. The conversation kind of got diverted while we were talking about that, and I wanted to bring it back around to you.
Right, and this is looking at it at the national level. Basically, one of the items that did occur were the option arms that were being made early in the 2000 to 2005. at one time, and I would go to quite a few different conventions, but I had heard that Countrywide at one time had 30% of their portfolio in option arms. Luckily, in the state of Indiana, it was less than 3%. The option arms were being made on a lot of the properties in areas where the appreciation rate was considerably higher than ours, up to 10 to 20 or even 30% per year. But at some point in time, that has to stop.
And I want to make sure, you, with this stuff, the terms can get confusing.
Sure.
ARMS, obviously, is adjustable rate mortgage.
Right. Well, and then the option on there is they have the option as to which payment that they want to make. They can make even a negative amortization. Basically, they're paying less than what they're not even covering the interest rate on there. They can make a regular payment based on a 30-year amortization, or in some cases, they had the option to not even make a payment for 1 month out of the year.
We have gotten an email question from a listener named Katie Sullivan, who apparently lives in Speedway. She says, you mentioned earlier that in the late 1990s or early 2000s, Indiana had one of the highest rates of foreclosure in the nation. As a newlywed at the time, I was looking for a house in 2000, and we bought a foreclosed property. What was Indiana doing differently at that time that led to such a high rate of foreclosure? We didn't have the unemployment issue at that time. Al Thorpe, please.
Actually, John, one of the things that one of the main reasons we did lead the nation at that time was a recession hit us before others.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not have that housing appreciation rate that many parts of the country had. So being in the Rust Belt early in the last decade, we went from being in the middle of the pack with delinquencies and foreclosures to leading the pack. And that had everything to do with economics and combination of that and the housing prices not zooming up like they did across the country.
Art, welcome to the program. How are you doing?
Just fine. I wanted to make several quick points. I know you don't have too much time.
Certainly, yeah. Please do be
quick. These are all based on various experiences either I had or the people I know have had. I have learned from lenders directly that they say they have called you on their records if the phone rings only three times, even if it doesn't get a voicemail, i.e. that they don't affect real communication. They just have it on their list that they tried. Number two, I know several people who had called their mortgage companies, and their mortgage companies told them that the mortgage was fine, behind but no problem, even when this, and then later on they found that they were in foreclosure after they'd been trying five or six times because they didn't think it was quite true. Number three, calls to the mortgage company that were answered, and then they were put on hold, and they were put on hold for 40 to 70 minutes or forwarded to three, four, five, or six different other numbers, and then back to the first one without any success, showing a somewhat dysfunctional processing system. Number four was about four different experiences I can personally attest to. The mortgage banker who said, I moved back to Illinois to my family because I'm leaving the mortgage banking profession because it is not an honorable profession. It is dishonorable, dishonest, and corrupt. I've seen it day in and day out, and I'm sick. Number two, or B, the mortgage broker who told the appraiser, yeah, it's a $150,000 property. He wants a $170,000 loan just to make it worth $250,000. C, the city county security guard who said, yeah, the nine guys in suits taken out in handcuffs were all mortgage brokers. One blew the whistle on them. And D, the mortgage banker whose loan package just showed principal and interest on a very low teaser rate, and when asked, what about taxes and insurance, was told, don't worry about that. You won't need to deal with that for 3 to 4 to 5 years. All four of those occurred in the spring and early summer of 2007, before subprime hit the fan. Thought you'd like to know about that.
Well, thank you, and we'll take that up. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Art Thorpe, I think probably that fits more into your wheelhouse than anybody else's. And I'm going to try to summarize because there was a lot there and a lot to keep track of. It's really, to some degree, seemed to be about questions of ethical behavior in the mortgage banking. Are there codes of conduct or ethical guidelines that mortgage bankers have to observe, and when somebody doesn't observe them, what's the policing procedure, basically?
Well, John, absolutely there are codes of conduct, and for our association, we have a code of ethics that all of our members are aware of. But I don't want to challenge Art in what he said there, but a couple of things I do want to bring up. It's sort of an oxymoron to have somebody say you're behind on your mortgage payment, but there's no problems.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I don't doubt that he heard that, but that doesn't make sense. There are bad apples in every profession, no matter what you go into, and the mortgage industry has suffered from that as well. As a result of some of what went on earlier, the Secure and Fair Enforcement Act was passed in 2008 and became part of Indiana law, where more people today in the business have to get a license. They have to have continuing education. They have code of ethics and conduct that they have to live by. And if they don't live by that, they end up in jail just like every other person that in their profession doesn't do what they're supposed to do. We expect our members and we expect our industry to treat consumers fairly, properly. But as with, again, any profession, any group, people can get in. And part of the challenge earlier was the barrier to get in was so low. It's mm-hmm. much higher today, financially and otherwise.
Well, I'm going to throw this one to Stephanie Reeve. Suppose someone is convinced that he or she has not been treated fairly or ethically by a lender. Mm-hmm. What can that person do? I mean, how would that person begin to understand what his or her rights might be and how to protect those rights?
Right. We always recommend that the greatest place to start is to contact the Indiana Attorney General's office and file a consumer complaint with the Homeowner Protection Unit. We work very closely with them, and they're the first point of contact. If you think this is the same also, if you're in trouble and somebody's contacted you and guarantees that they can help you get out of foreclosure and they ask for money up front, that's what we call a foreclosure rescue scam, and you should also contact the Attorney General's office in that case.
So the Attorney General then basically is your first point of contact there.
Right, and I do not have that information in front of me, but if you contact the Indiana Foreclosure Prevention Network, they can direct you to the AG's office.
And is there a website? Again, don't mm-hmm. Given the level of interest we've got from callers on this,
certainly.
Feel free to shamelessly plug that website.
Certainly. I would recommend going to www.877gethope.org, or you can call our toll-free helpline, 1-877-GET-HOPE.
We are talking about the foreclosure crisis and the central Indiana housing market. Ken, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Hello to your panel. I just have a quick question. What programs are actually being used? The government said that they had these wonderful options for distressed homeowners. Is anyone able to finally get these banks and lenders to actually make use of these?
Yes, we will take that up. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Stephanie Reeve.
Well, I presume the caller is probably talking about the Making Home Affordable program,
mm-hmm.
Which primarily consists of HAMP, home affordable modifications, and we do see those in Indiana. The federal government also awarded Indiana $221 million late last year in an additional program to assist unemployed homeowners. It's basically a non-recourse loan while someone's unemployed to help them find new employment and get back up on their feet. So those are not great tools. There are a variety of other programs I won't bore you with under Making Home Affordable. And there are a lot of options.
Well, let me by the way, it's not boring, but but what I guess I would say then, are there further modifications in the law that any of you would recommend to sort of keep us from seeing, because these are not happy outcomes. I mean, that when somebody loses a home, that's devastating. Are there government remedies or legal remedies that might prevent us from facing this quite as often? Stephanie Reeve.
I would like to talk about something that actually the Indiana General Assembly instituted in 2009, and that is everyone in the state of Indiana has the right to a face-to-face meeting with their lender at the court prior to the lender taking that home in a foreclosure. When you receive a foreclosure notice from your lender, you're informed of that right. Not enough people take advantage of that. When folks go to those which we call settlement conferences, they are especially here in Marion County, extremely effective. Very, very often there are modifications or other workouts done, and both the lender and the homeowner leave happy.
Dan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Certainly, glad to do it.
I'm a disabled vet, Panama in the Gulf. Because of some of the unseen things with TBI and PTSD, my wife had taken a sort of a demotion over at Riley Hospital, so she can help me work on those issues. In the interim, we've tried to work with our lender, which was originally Countrywide, because we had some damage to our house from the storms in 2008. And it took us till February 2009 to work out a deal, which we were supposed to do certain things. And by July 2009, we were supposed to have a loan modification. Well, the interim, Bank of America took over. And since then till now, they have delayed and denied us every attempt we've had to restructure our loan. We've gone to the Department of Treasury, which shows the different programs, and you can put in your information. And it shows that we're qualified for three different programs of making loan of home affordable, the second, and then the distress state one. Another thing that put us underwater is we had to take out a FEMA SBA loan to fix our home. So we were kind of hoping to get our home modified, but it seems like Bank of America especially is a master at delaying. And when we made a complaint to the Office of Comptroller of Currency, they responded back with lies, even though we've recorded the conversations with Bank of America. Now Bank of America won't even take our calls because they know we're recording them. And all their correspondence is, anyway, my point being is, what is the pushback from you representatives to make companies like Bank of America be more responsible to the oversight that they're in compliance with the lending practices?
Al Thorup, and thanks for the call, Dan.
Yeah, John, I mentioned earlier federal consent orders. Bank of America is part of the 14 servicers that were involved in this, and that does include improving their loss mitigation efforts and foreclosure proceedings. And with the Dodd-Frank Act that was passed last year, there's a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that is going to come to fruition here in July. They are a sweeping agency once they get going that is there with the primary purpose of taking care of consumers and listening to them and reacting for them with lender servicers across the country and mortgages as well as other financial products across the board. But it is a challenge for a lot of consumers, and each person's case is individual. And so there's no blanket answer to Dan's problem, unfortunately.
Well, and it sounds like in some ways he hit kind of a perfect storm here, too,
yes.
And that there were a lot of issues involved. But, you know, what should be, and I've asked this question once before and know you've answered it, but given the level of interest and, frankly, the level of distress on the part of our callers, it bears asking again. If you're getting into trouble or you're beginning to feel like you're taking on a lot of water, what should your steps be, the first steps? Stephanie Reeve.
I would say the first step would be to contact the Indiana Foreclosure Prevention Network at www.877-GET-HOPE.org or call the helpline at 1-877-GET-HOPE. If you'd prefer not to do that, contact your lender. Open your mail when whatever the lender sends you. I know a lot of the clients that we assist stop opening the mail from the lender because collections are calling them all the time. They will often send communications with numbers and contacts to call. So that's also a very good option.
Well, and Al Thorup, I want to ask, since some of this is about unresponsive lenders, basically, that they try to call and engage and don't get any feel like they're not getting any response. Is there someone they can call with your association who will work with the lenders then and say, in effect, could you return the phone call? These folks really do want to try to work with you.
Well, our association is happy to help consumers in any way that we can. We have a website, www.indianamba.org. And to the extent that we can assist, I can assist consumers, happy to do so. We have approximately 55 lender servicers that are members across the state. But I've talked to consumers myself personally who are working with lenders that are not part of our association. And I have a great understanding of what it's like to lose a job. I've done it myself. I got on a phone call one day, and 5 minutes later, I was out of a job. I was fortunate in that I didn't have to worry about my next mortgage payment, but I know where a lot of consumers are at. It took me 4 months to get a job. So I have a lot of empathy, and to the extent that I can help, happy to.
Is there a number through your association they can call, an 800 or anything like that to get contact? Or
no, it's just a local number, and I would suggest that if they would first try the Indiana Foreclosure Prevention Network, they are staffed very well to take care of those situations. But, again, we'll help in any way that we can. And we have a good partnership with the Indiana Foreclosure Prevention Network and Indiana Housing.
We do.
We have run out of time. I would like to thank our guest, Stephanie Reeve of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority. Stephanie, it was a pleasure having you here.
Thank you.
Al Thorup, Executive Director of the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association. Al, enjoyed talking with you.
Likewise, thank you.
Scott Smith of Keller Williams Realty, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, John.
And I'd also like to thank all of our listeners for the great questions and comments. We will be back next week for our next edition of No Limits. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism. Thank you for spending this time with us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Jeanette Rhodes. Board Engineer, Matt Sosi, and Intern, Monica Schwab. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.